Hi everyone, welcome back to the Lake Podcast. How are cities created? How are they made? History suggests that cities are made and remade through land acquisition and dispossession. But what about nature? What about the environment, the ecologies that surround and constitute the ballast or core around which cities are made and remade? How does human ingenuity and effort manage, deal with, and contend with nature to create cities? In a remarkable book, a magisterial work of environmental and legal history, historian Debjani Bhattacharya explores how radical ecological change contributed to and precipitated the making of Calcutta. Her book, Empire and Ecology in the Bengal Delta, The Making of Calcutta, vividly details colonial efforts from the 18th century that transformed Calcutta's soggy, marshy, unruly riverine spaces into landed spaces upon which commercial, financial, and industrial activities occurred. Empire and Ecology in the Bengal Delta is a fascinating look at how colonial officials dealt with ecological issues, especially when legal categories and conceptions differentiating land and water were unhelpful or in many cases non-existent. For instance, how does one make claims to riverine spaces? How could soggy marshes be made landed properties? To answer these questions, Bhattacharya uses an innovative method, the almanac, that allows her to generate a vivid account of colonial city making across geographies, times, and scales. Here is Debjani Bhattacharya on Empire and Ecology in the Bengal Delta, The Making of Calcutta, published by Cambridge University Press in 2018. Before we talk about the book, can you maybe just give our listeners a sense of how you became interested in not only this fascinating topic, but also trying to meld legal and environmental histories together to understand the making of Calcutta?
Thanks so much, Karthik, for that question. it was an interesting beginning because I began very differently when I went to the archive. Back in 2008 or 9, my project was an attempt to look at the question of housing and houselessness in a historical perspective, because I was kind of curious when it came to agrarian property. South Asian historiography is so extraordinarily rich in writing about the question of property from an intellectual angle, from an angle of looking at social transformation of lives, of inheritance, of gender, sexuality, of agrarian transformation. But when it came to the question of urban property, it was an anthropological question. It almost felt like anthropologists write about slum development, rights to the city, as if that was not even a historical issue. So I wanted to write the longer history. And I also at the time was involved in a project in Calcutta, which was not necessarily linked to my dissertation, but had been working with Calcutta Samaritans and the Women's Studies School in Jadavpur, who were doing a survey of, you know, homeless people's imagination of what a home would look like. Because by 2010, as you know, Harsh Mandar's case has resulted in the mandate to build shelters for homeless people. So I was involved with that project. So naturally, I was kind of very curious about it. And I took Matthew Hull's word very seriously when Matthew Hull said, you know, there is the government of, like in government of paper, there is the world of municipal reports, there is the world of maps and everything. And then there is the real lived life in a South Asian city, which doesn't necessarily map on. And I was like, okay, there are all these reports, If you walk into the municipal archives, which is about, you know, slum development, slum relocation, slum raising, slum clearance, but clearly that didn't happen. These slums exist. There is the political society, as Partho Chatterjee would say, where they have their own kinds of political claim making in the city. So what exactly, how does a historian map this story out? So I moved to the legal archive to see cases of, you know, eviction, look for property disputes and various kinds. And what I found increasingly, and I remember most of 2008, I actually sent back those files, were like, oh, you are occupying my drain. That's actually not a land, that is a bog. You know, those kinds, that's a swamp that needs to be drained. Who's in charge of draining? And I was like, that's not my interest. I kept moving it away. And and of course, it was summer vacation. As a grad student, summer and monsoon, I was in the archive. It was a July afternoon. I step out of the archive and I'm knee deep in water. And suddenly I start thinking, okay, like Calcutta's history has been written very much as a history of drainage, disciplining, you know, sanitization, how drainage committee did this, that, and the other. I'm like, the city is not necessarily drained if you think about it. And that's what got me thinking. I was like, okay, there is a story I have to write about the water. Here I'm standing in Egypt and water. There are all these cases about the water. And so that's when I went back and looked at it with a new eyes and a new lens. And then I realized, okay, there's a different story that needs to be told about the city and its watery origins and what really happened to the water, like what happened to all these property disputes. That's how I went back. Now, the legal part of the archive, like my work was kind of set because of that, because I was necessarily working with the judicial department papers. I was working with these cases. I never even thought of myself as an environmental historian. I wasn't even trained as an environmental historian, but I couldn't make sense of my archival material as I got deeper into it. And I remember in 2010, I was like leafing around through the library at Emory. And I of course, I knew William Cronin's book, Nature's Metropolis, but then I started reading up about the Mississippi and the Mississippi Delta, about New Orleans. So Ari Kelman, Christopher Morris's Big Muddy, Ari Kelman's River and its City. And I was like, okay, there is this other angle I have to talk about, because South Asian environmental history is very much about, as they say, forest and the fields, not about the urban. Mm. And that's how the urban and the environmental started coming together for me in some ways.
So, I mean, that was going to be my next question, which you already answered a little bit. But there's also a clear kind of focus in the book of moving away from existing maps, right? What you call cartographic mindedness, and not using that to understand how Calcutta, you know, the origins of Calcutta and how it evolved, but actually just going back and just looking at these marshes, these other kinds of aqueous spaces to understand that beginning, right?
Mm. So that's an interesting question. So, you know, like if you go to the archive, you realize that the cartographic mindedness that I called is actually not necessarily present. And I say that right in the beginning of the book, you know, like so much of the historiography alerts us to the fact that the colonial powers were all about fixing in writing. You know, this is the overwhelming historiography of post-colonial historiography, like it's all about fixing, it's all about flattening, it's all about erasing diversity. But I met all these engineers and, you know, proper surveyors who were very aware this is a mobile landscape. And they were like, there was an engineer called William Sage, who's writing a letter from South 24 Parganas in the Bengal Delta to Calcutta and saying, you know, rivers don't have a margin over here. You have to understand that. And our entire irrigation engineering is built on a supposition of a margin. And therefore, we really need to turn to what the vernacular, the Bangla language over here, because they don't use the word river. They call these nalas. And he translates nalas as spill channels. And he said, and that's a very different thing than a river. And how would our science, how should my engineering change if I begin from not supposing a margin? Another person writes and says, I cannot, like he's in charge of building the station, the Shalda station in Calcutta. He said, I cannot build on a bottomless alluvium. Our entire engineering is based on understanding the depth ends, like you bore down and you hit ground. You just bow down and it's a geezer. He writes about it. So they're kind of aware that this doesn't really work out. So James Rennell, who did this 13-year survey, who's very famous for doing his survey of the Bengal Delta over 13 years, and he draws the first kind of a proper mapping, he is brought to testify in a legal case about, you know, this kind of marsh. Is it marsh? Is it water? And he says, and it's very interesting. He says, you know, maps and property deeds do not reflect the reality on the ground. We all know that. Why are we? So there was this awareness of this disjuncture, but we, of course, understand maps and look at it. You know, maps become, if you open up any urban history book, they begin with a mapping. This is the municipally bounded area. This is going to define my history. And we do it very without questioning, uncritically, right? But if I want to, and then we, of course, say urban, rural, let's think about the peri-urban. So these are all municipal kind of imaginations, that they are powerful. But what if I began from the drainage system to think about the city? And that made me understand, okay, when we draw a map, we are actually, like, if I draw this map in the month of August, I am fixing on paper what a temporary landscape is. And the British were very aware of that. They said, look, do not do surveys till monsoon has receded. So there was always mandate that you do not begin a land survey in the Bengal Delta for agrarian and urban till October, because the water recedes and that's when. So they had made a very particular decision of when they will see the land as land, and it is seasonal. So it's like written into this extraordinarily boring revenue documents that we have to be aware of the seasonality. There are attempts to, of course, fix it in multiple ways. But there was, so I started asking, okay, what if I begin to think about these maps as something that was frozen in time, as where we are drawing and saying, I'm taking this particular moment in the movement of land and water in this particular month, and that's how I'm going to draw the map. And you know what's very interesting? I once met this architect. She's an architect in Bangladesh, Marina Tabassum, and she does work on, you know, thinking about shelters in chores and mobile landscape. And she has been reading my book, and she said, you know, what's very interesting is what's happening at the moment is, so suppose you are living in a chore and your land disappears. The district magistrate sits down with the old British map in the new land formation and tries to divide it up by overlaying that, which is a very interesting way of dealing with mapping as a very flexible kind of a document, not as a document of fixing. So I thought, yeah, so there is, so that's what I was kind of working out of.
So you the book focuses on soaked ecologies, right? Or the aqueous and riverine spaces that fundamentally makes it hard to distinguish between land and water, but also how vital water was to land making itself, right? So as you mentioned, it's important to pay attention to how swamps, marshes, bogs, and riverbeds were transformed into these fixed landed properties through colonial instruments. Two questions here. How did you think through centering this project through ecological change, particularly? And I guess Calcutta helped in, you know, quite easily in that sense. And second is, why have scholars forgotten about this fluid past, Calcutta's fluid past?
So there are two reasons. So the soaked word, actually, the word soaking actually came from Dilip Dakuna and Anuradha Mathu. These are landscape artists, their work. And after the Mumbai flooding of 2005, I think they did a nice exhibition. And then out of the exhibition emerged a book called Soak, Mumbai in an Estuary. And that was very formative for me thinking. And so I borrow the word soaked from there. Like, soaked ecology is a development of their idea for soak. And they were pushing as landscape artists, landscape architects. It's like, what if we imagine land as not land and water separated by a human-made land in Mumbai, and then, oh my God, flooding, what do? We will see walls. What if we understand the relation as a relationship of soaking? Like, it seasonally gets soaked. And I was like, okay, that is, and he was like, they live in Philadelphia, and happenstance that when I moved here for my job, I reached out to them and we started talking. And I would say, you know, I have found these kinds of Bangla proverbs that talk about a very different relation to land, because there's this saying that during monsoon, my land is steaming with life, a farmer often says, which basically hints of the fact that it's full of fish, and he goes fishing in his agrarian landscape. And you see the seasonal kind of usage in 1790s. I find this very interesting. This would be in present-day Bangladesh. This landowner, zamindar, writes to the East India Company and say, during the month of monsoon, I'm not a zamindar, I'm a samundardar, owner of a sea. So the tax, land tax revenue that you ask of me cannot be fulfilled over the month of monsoon because I cease to be a zamindar. Of course, it is, he is trying to like play this whole landscape. So I was like, okay, there is this going on, and we have somehow, you know, the language was not in some ways there. Even when I began my project, for me to understand what's going on, are these like quirky little documents, or is there enough for me to build a case? And soon enough, I realized there is enough for me to build a case. When it comes to agrarian landscape, people had already done some work. You know, if you look at Nitin Sinha's work, he had worked on Chaur and Daira. He wrote this wonderful essay before, like maybe in the early 2010s, in 2011 or 12, about, you know, the settlement of Chaur and Daira. Rohan D'Souza writes about it in his book about, you know, how these kind of agrarian landscapes were managed. Kuntala Lahiri Dotto and Gopa Shamanto had done the work on the dancing in their ethnographic book called Dancing with the River on this kind of sedentary landscape. But, you know, these were always in the margins in some ways. And while there was an understanding of the sedimentation in the agrarian landscape, our urban frames had been so much by the 90s defined by a kind of a Foucauldian kind of a training of disciplining spaces and disciplining population. Somehow there are other kinds of things we forgot to look at. So whenever we see draining, and we have often read as historian, oh, they're draining the marshes or draining the slums, draining the landscape to basically discipline the population and evict them. We have, because though that was such an overwhelming imagination, we often fail to read the archives properly. And it's not like these are very arcane documents. You open up any, you go to the West Bengal State Archive, open up any dispute document, and it's all over the place. And it's also interesting because, you know, there are two books, one in the 70s and one colonial history book that talks about from marsh to the metropolis, like Calcutta's transformation. So the first medical topography of Calcutta is all about talking about the marshes. So it's not like it's there, it's all over the place. But our eyes were trained into not seeing it as a historical category to think about and write about in an important way. But I think it's changing. Now you have so many interesting works. You have work on the Gotlands up in the Scandinavia. You have the work on the Fens and the Moors in England. So it's all over. You have work coming out of New Orleans. So people are actually looking at these kind of temporary landscapes, I think.
So the book is called Empire and Ecology in the Bengal Delta. So central to this making of Calcutta was colonial power. Yeah. And how it was wielded through various actors and instruments. And I think what mattered here was the British reliance on two entangled registers of power that you note in the book, the legal register and the technological register, both of which helped colonial officials develop properties for financial speculation. Conceptually, what helped you, I mean, how did you make sense of thinking about property as technology to unpack the commodification that was occurring, but also how these lands allowed for power to be shifted from the locals to the colonial state?
So there are two questions here, right? Let me begin with the second question, the shift of power. You know, and I looked at, so property has been such an important category to understand colonial power. If you think from, you know, Anthony Pagden, Ranajit Guha, Uday Mehta, all of them, you know, there's either it's a history of liberalism or it's a history of shifts of power, or it's like the disentangling, like the unraveling of the agrarian power or the creation of the rentier class and all of that. When it comes to the urban, we're not talking about massive spaces of land. We're talking about small plots of land, honestly. Really, really tiny plots of land. But what you see that is getting reworked in the urban sphere, when you look at urban property making and city building, is kind of a managerial state emerging. And what you see as part of the emergence of the managerial state is the East India Company, which has been understood as an company state formation in the early modern political authority. And I'm thinking here of Philip Stern's work, which says, you know, this is a kind of a beast. It's an emergence in the new time. It's a joint stock company, but it's also a state. What I saw was an emergence of a company as a land developer. Now, if you think at the moment, land developers are really, really important people, political actors in India. And not just in India, if you think of North America, we did have a property developer as a president. So, but putting that aside, there is a kind of a power accumulation that is happening where the East India Company was becoming a land developer and the custodian of public lands in the city. And that's a story we haven't really told properly, because the imagination was that East India Company never really owned land in the city. It was a tax farmer, it was a revenue farmer, it was drawing revenue. But imagination of this company as a landowner who is doing things in the city was somehow went missing, because it was municipal histories of disciplining, but not the history of the company as a landowner and a land developer. So that allowed me to tell a story of conquest, which was a managerial form, how kind of recalcitrance gets produced, how like overnight a certain form of ownership gets discounted. What happens when paper gets introduced as a marker of property ownership, and how did the paper come about? You know, through river shifting, cadastral mapping failing, then saying, you can make a claim on a land by showing you have a patta. If you don't have a patta, you have to have it registered by the town police. You know, it's like what allowed this movement of the water became a very productive way to think about it. And that comes to the first question you ask about, you know, the technological and the legal registers. And what I try to show is, you know, I began with this case of the harbor that sinks, and it's a failed harbor project. And, you know, like there are many ways to tell the story, and you could tell the story of the there's this English entrepreneurial guy who tries to build a harbor and the nature, tropical nature, overwhelms him. But that's, if tropical nature really was overwhelming the landscape, and you know, Laurie Benton in her Search for Sovereignty talks about the legal limits, the natural limits to the penetration of legal power. Why did this behemoth, this earth-hungry British Empire become really, earth-hungry East India Company become the British Empire? How did it then manage to overcome? And for me, the story of overcoming was important. So that's where I showed, like, you know, if we try to tell the story of draining, we'll always tell the story of failure. Oh, the British tried draining and they failed. What's much more important is how they got around the draining process. And I think, as I started mapping that, I realized, you know, it was a much more act of us developing nomenclature, because once you are able to name something within a legal debate, you can actually fix it. So if you call them marsh, slowly accreted land, you can develop a whole host of legal laws to regulate it. It's only when you can do that, that does it shift to an engineering account, because then the engineer says, okay, this is a land where I can do this or that, I'll build here, build there. And what's also interesting, you know, I've been looking at maps for the last maybe 10 years now, of various survey maps, various mapping in Calcutta. And one of the things I've seen, and my colleagues in Chennai actually confirmed, they are seeing the same thing, is once, before a water body disappears in reality through engineering or draining, it is first made to disappear in maps. That's how power works at the paper. So you would see a water tank or that any tala or something which is marked blue, a few years later it becomes a green space. But it is not necessarily because it's been drained. They are marking it out to be drained. So Bhavani Raman, who's working on Chennai, she's working on the Ennore Creek. And she shows how before Ennore Creek still exists as a creek, but because of SEZ rules and everything, it doesn't exist in the map anymore. So it is made to disappear in the map. So that's when I was trying to look for the power of exactly what is happening. So I said, the operations of colonial power really operates in as a dialogue between these two registers, between the legal register and the technological register. And that allowed me to think about property also itself as a technology, where you see land where there was never any land in the first place. And that allows you to do certain things with that space.
The other aspect to this colonial practice was the knowledge about the Bengal Delta landscape and how that could be deployed to bolster this land making, which brings us to the case of Benjamin Latham, which you, I think, referenced in that answer. How did Latham's case influence British strategy, particularly new ideas to govern this fluid landscape?
So Lekham's case, it's a, I would say there is not necessarily, you don't see a direct kind of a link, but it was a big case. It's a case that goes on for 30 years. It's in the imagination. It doesn't get settled in the Mayor's Court in Calcutta. It lands up then in the House of Commons in London. It is a fat little book. But that imagination is there. It's not just also Lekham's, but one case. What's happening is this is also a time they're doing land settlements all across the Bengal Delta. 1793 Permanent Settlement Act is passed. They're doing land settlement. And recently, Erica Mukherjee has written a wonderful work where she shows, if you look at all the cases in that Sadar Diwani Adalat, you see that the permanent settlement of land, as we've said, had been undone by misrecognizing land titling and land ownership in the Bengal Delta was actually also a matter of misrecognizing. This was an impermanent land on which you tried to do permanent settlement. So she looks at various kinds of embankment cases, cases of washed away embankment, to show that that the British were like completely, this was completely failing project. It's all about fixing the land. And that this land kept shifting. And so there was a lot of cases. So that was there. People were already writing about the fact that it is very difficult also to often give postmen and sailors directions because the land would shift. And said, so you may have to make sure your understanding of how to move from the Sundarbans up to the Calcutta is current and not 2 years old or 3 years old because the land will have shifted. So there was already this kind of an imagination. And then Lakham's really massive case, which is not about agrarian landscape where you can recalibrate yield and redo your revenue measurement, but this has to be fixed to be able to build, comes to the fore. And it is around this time you see that the Bengal land acquisition gets passed. The first land acquisition law in India, people who work on it go back to it. There are two clauses. One, they say we need to acquire land for salt pans, for drain and all of that. And the other, they say, is to basically decide on this mobility of the land and water. And within a year, and this is within 5 years, they also passed the Bengal alluvial and diluvial law. And in doing that, they basically, the law report that comes out of it, they say they sit down with, you know, Islamic legal scholars and Hindu legal scholars and try to understand how land adjudication was happening when there were embankment shifts and border shifts. And they come up with they actually do a deep dive into these laws and pick whatever is comfortable for them, whatever looks familiar. And of course, they also turn to Roman law. And there's a legal scholar based out of Oxford, Joshua Getzler, who says, you know, even when you look at English water laws, which is happening around the same time in 1790s, water laws is being fixed in England. It is what you realize is even water laws in England are very Romanesque. And it's one of the most Romanesque of all their laws. It's not governed necessarily always by common law. So you see what they do is they take this Roman law imagination of alluvial, diluvial, they find what's similar in the existing Indic laws, what is commensurate with their imagination, and then they write it down as the Bengal Alluvial Diluvial Act. So this is how they were reworking the thing.
Chapter 3, which is fascinating, engages with the vernacular representations of riverine spaces and how locals and citizens in Calcutta imagined and inhabited them. So there's a focus on folk songs, poems, storytelling, and other forms of art depicting this deltaic environment and the people who lived and worked with them. Their inclusion, I think, testifies to the importance of anchoring such histories on people and how they navigate and understand these massive shifts that are happening around them. It was just a very compelling chapter for that reason. Was it difficult to weave these perspectives into the narrative without, I guess, sacrificing the core argument in a way?
It was actually one of the most tough chapters to write. It shifted around, and the tougher thing was, how do you write about this without romanticizing the past and saying, oh, people had an environmental consciousness in the early pre-colonial world was somehow much better than the colonial world. And I think that there's a lot of work to be done still with the vernacular material. But, you know, like I speak Bangla, I grew up in Kolkata, and I was always struck by how deeply riverine a language was. How deeply, you know, river is such an important form of a philosophical thinking when you think about folk songs and stuff. you know, some of these songs I actually quote are not even songs that you find in the archive. I grew up with. I just had to like sit down and like translate the songs and think about it carefully. So I was what, and so that brought me the question of what do I do with this material, which is like, which is so different from the bureaucratic material I was looking at. So I got two clues. First, I got this interesting case where the British pay the deity. Among all the people they have to pay compensation, they pay to nobody but to the deity. And it's, so I was like, okay, this is an interesting thing going on over here. Like even the mundane British bureaucracy has a way to deal with river spirits, and I can't even work with this as a historian, because, you know, we as historians want to have a secular understanding of our archive. But that also, it was around that time I actually discovered Paul Carter's work called Dark Writing and Road to Botany Bay, where he really thinks about how do we think about landscape and write about landscape that is, that has to necessarily work with the state archive, but also state archive that actually leaves out this entire world of gestures and understandings. So, and I turned a lot to ethnographic work. You know, the other work that I was, that really helped me think through was Catherine Verderi, very different work about post-socialist Romanian property regime, where she tries to think about everything that was, you know, that got regularized in the in that post-socialist transformation. Vanishing Hectares, her book, post-socialist transformation of ownership and what got lost out of the archive. So that's how I said, okay, I have to think about it and write about it and let this work as a counterfoil without sort of doing this division between this colonizing blinkered vision vis-a-vis romantic pre-colonial. And I think that the story of the deity really helped me think through how do these things operate within the mundane in some ways. I'm still like, I often like, I thought of first beginning with that. Let this be the opening, because once you begin with something like this, it defines what your the rest of your chapters would look like. But of course, I struggled, as you see, a lot with it, and it became the third chapter of the book, and I think it works there. But you know, I think there is so much more to be done with that material.
This is a history that matters for what's happening in Calcutta today, as detailed in chapter 4, which covers landmaking in the recent past that's dominated by speculative activities, especially real estate, which really now imperils Calcutta's wetlands and marshlands, right?
Yeah.
I think when you add climate change to the equation, it just shows that this situation is unsustainable, the extraction of land for private gain and the level at which it's happening.
Yeah.
And as you correctly write, and such practices are fueled by a collective amnesia about Calcutta's fluid pasts, right? Is there a politics of resistance today that can push back against what's happening now and in the future?
And there is already a bit of a movement. So there are, you know, there are two kinds of environmentalism in India, as people have always pointed out. There's the bourgeois environmentalism of green spaces, and there is the environmentalism of the poor. What's very interesting, you know, when I was like through the 2000s, when I was growing up in Calcutta, the main environmentalism was about protecting the maidan, the green space, which was a very much of a bourgeois environmentalism. Whereas there's always been a movement on the sidelines, and a movement that was now increasingly being reported on about the wetlands. So it's like fishers live in the wetlands. And it took me, and I, as a person growing up in the city, it was so much not part of the ecosystem of like our information ecosystem, that it was only as a college student that I found out much more about it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it is one of the biggest cities, one of the more densely populated cities without a sewage treatment plant, because we have a natural, it's often called a living infrastructure, because it naturally treats through its aerobic and anaerobic ponds, the city sewage. And Dhrubajyoti Ghosh, who had been very, very active in getting the Ramsar Convention recognition, of the wetlands, called it the kidneys of the city, and said if that collapses, it will collapse. But of course, this is also a period when the Housing Development Authority is becoming extraordinarily powerful. And now, of course, like the Housing Authority is very well engrafted into political power in Calcutta. So it is, and they are very active in this area. This is going to be the new town area. This is the new town area of Calcutta, which, you know, Kollan Shannal has called the bypass urbanism of Indian cities. They you have the congestion of the center city. What do? You build your airport and everything in the peri-urban area where you transform, you displace people, you transform the landscape. It just turns out for Calcutta, unlike Bangalore or any other places, it's a wetland, which is very critical to protecting the city and the surrounding area. And we are quite very quickly transforming that landscape. It's also very contested. I know a lot of people, ethnographers, who are doing work and trying to document what's going on. It is also not anybody would be aware of how the criminal and the property development world sit very close together. So it's not an easy ethnographic work. But there is now thanks to, I would say, the work of Dhrubojyoti Ghosh and his students, that there is a very much a mainstream awareness of the wetlands, which also has its pitfalls, because now our current CM is very much like taking up some of the wetland lakes and like beautifying it and marking it out as these are the lakes. So there is always another politics of what Karen Coelho, who's an anthropologist in Chennai, calls it the lakeification, a kind of beautification, where we are somehow now saying, oh, this water is important for the city, but then what we need to do is displace the people. So this fall, there was this water logging in Calcutta due to heavy rains through October. And then what you see, so on the newspapers overwhelmingly saying, oh, you know, the Calcutta's wetlands and the canals around the Calcutta's wetlands in the Salt Lake area are all full of squatters. And particularly, there's a canal called Baghjula, full of squatters. We need to evict them and let the canals flow freely, which you see, like even when a movement begins, it can easily be derailed, but it's never saying, oh, we are actually not protecting the Ramsar site and we are building flyovers and building housing there. It's not that. Let's evict the people who are actually living on stilts and they're fine and they're not necessarily waterlogging the landscape. So it's that there is a movement, though. There is an awareness. And I think Amitav Ghosh's work has also popularized, made mainstream in the Great Derangement, that this is a city that's extraordinarily threatened. And there is enough reporting following the IPCC report that Calcutta is one of the cities, like Dhaka, like Chennai, about to be washed away by the 2070. So it's grim. It's pretty grim.
In terms of the method, I wanted to get to this earlier, but I don't want to miss asking you about it. Or the almanac. The book's innovative since it allows you to cross multiple times, spaces, and scales, and use a diverse range of materials, artifacts, and knowledge, both Western and Indigenous, that can, and I quote here, gather together a multitude of inhabited worlds, rational, natural, and spiritual. The approach is really ambitious, but also grounded and practical. Tell us about how and why you opted to use the almanac.
Almanac is it's interesting. So how did I come about using the almanac? So this was the whole thing. You know, I was trying to write about a tidal landscape, right? And tides are recurrent things. They are cyclical. They keep happening over and over again. Whereas and the tidal landscape actually affects what happens to the property. What your foreshore looks like is very much dependent on what happens to the tide. So I was like, okay, there is this kind of a cyclical logic defined by the moon and the placement of the moon and the tide, which is a very different charting. And then there is the mapping of the space, the property deed with its clean, neat lines. How do I put these two together? How do I think of a space that is knotted together? And it is then I started thinking of this Gautam Bhadra's work on... it's called Nera Kobar Bortolaija. It's in Bangla. And he tries to think about, you know, this historical knots. And the book is very much about this historical knots and how does one think through historical knots? How does one not say there are these hermetically sealed worlds of the indigenous and the colonial? But how does one think about this in a knotted? And I realized I was actually not. And he writes a little bit about almanac and, you know, why were Bengali almanacs publishing railway times? You know, which is a very different thing, like railway times, prices. So he was trying to think through this genre of the almanac. And then, so I'm trying to think, okay. And then he has a very interesting sentence that allowed me. He said, you know, what almanac does is think about time in a longitudinal way. And then there is this time, the linear time of colonial modernity. And we've written a lot about colonial modernity completely displacing other forms of time. But actually what happened was there was a knotting together. And both drew from the indigenous world also drew from it, and the colonial world also drew from it. And how do we write about it in a knotted manner? And what made me realize is I'm also writing about not a time, but a space, or a space-time that is kind of cyclical, that is doesn't follow the neat topography of it was a marsh, and then one day it became a drained property, then one day it became a speculative thing. No, it is much more knotted together. It's how power got recalibrated and retransformed. And that's where I said, okay, how do we think about almanac as a spatial category? And I will add this, that I'm not sure I'm actually done with, I don't think I'm yet satisfied with how I have done it. I think there is much more thinking and developing need to be done with thinking about the almanac much more carefully. And I continue to work through that. I wrote an essay later, but I think I'm still continuing to think about what would be the, like, or thinking in terms of even writing a methods book on this almanac thinking and the historical archive.
So there's a burgeoning literature on South Asia's rivers and deltas in recent books by Sunil Amrit, Shidito Sen. But I see your work as having wider implications, not just in history, but in literatures like geography, anthropology, urban studies. Also, the book points to how I think scholars, social scientists especially, should foreground their work given climate change and how that could affect our current and future, right? I think scholars could now more, I think, cogently situate climate change when understanding empire, colonialism, and law, and how they all interacted to produce different outcomes across times and scales that are having an effect now. I'm curious where you see the book and relative to all these different strands that I've just laid out, and how it connects to what you want to do in the future.
It's
a big question. Yeah,
it is a big question. There's a famous line Foucault uses, said, "Once the book is out in the world, it takes a life of its own."
Yeah.
And so I never thought I was writing about rivers or water. Mm. So I knew I was writing about water, but I was writing about bogs. My friends were like, "Oh, I don't want to hear about another bog story, Dave Jenny. Can you just shut up with your bog and swamp stories?" And I thought I was writing about bogs and swamps, and I was writing the history that I was writing. I will say one of my teachers had told me, do not come to the archive with concepts. Let the archive help you come up with your own concepts and terminologies. And so often very good history and very creative minds die in the archive because they just come with a concept and fail to see what's in the archive. And I think that was very important. And he also said, like, if you're going to tell me another story about why Foucault's concept matter for Calcutta, I don't need to read your book. And I think there is some truth to it if it's going to be just an application of suit. See, this works. So I think that was very important to really let the archive generate the concepts in some ways and allow me to think through the historiography. So that was very important for me. And I think the book took the shape, therefore it took, because, you know, I had to do a lot of learning. As soon as I finished my PhD, I realized I often did not understand legal terms. So I actually spent a month in doing a summer academy in the Max Planck Institute of Legal History, because I thought I needed a grounding in legal history to understand that. And but one of the things I often say, actually talking about climate change, I said climate change today gives us a sense of allows us a language to make sense of the jagged coastline of the Bengal Delta and the fact that there's land subsidence happening. But it's not new. It's been happening for 200, 300 years or since it's existed. So today we are often using that frame, but even that frame can also limit us to understand the longer history that did not have much to do with climate change initially, but now has been aggravated, the land subsidence and the land with climate change. So how do we think in those terms? I was very glad to see like people working on rivers and environmental history take up my book. I thought I had written really very much a book about urban legal history and legal geography. So I was very surprised when that happened. And of course, in urban studies, I thought I was in communication with. So that that really was very gratifying. And people who are working on climate change, anthropologists have been reading my work, architects. So that was all very gratifying. I don't know how they all match up. But my second project emerges really very much out of the first project in some ways, because I was looking at all these cases about, about the validity of various kinds of geographical evidence and the development of geographical sciences in tandem and in conversation with the legal world. And so for my second book, I'm doing a very different project. It is also requiring me to do a lot of learning in climate science and understanding and reading up on climate science. But I'm really trying to look at how in the late 18th, early 19th century, before, meteorology and all of this become science, how very much of this science is emerging out of a kind of a nautical marketplace, as I call it, out of insurance contracts and records, which has to insure against cyclones, storms. So I'm looking at Lloyd's archive, the shipwreck records, and trying to work that out, how these kinds of battles sort of set the parameters of climate science as we know, or weather science as we knew it back then.
That was going to be my next question, actually, your next book, which has a title, Climate Futures Past, a Law and Weather Knowledge in the Indian Ocean World. Yeah. So you're covering that maritime landscape now.
Yes, and in a way, it comes out of very present day concerns. Begins with the question is, why have we overwhelmingly turned to finances and a financial reckoning to tackle our climate crisis? And the usual answer within the literature is it's the 1970s with the emergence of economic futurology that we see a neoliberalization of our policies. But I think there is an earlier history. If we think of weather derivatives as a kind of a commodity frontier, we can actually also go back and look at a similar, not continuous necessarily, but a similar commodity frontier at a time when trade in the East is increasing, but underwriting is becoming a booming business. So that's what I'm trying to map in my second book.
What was the hardest part of writing the book?
I think that, so I'm trained in literature. My bachelor's and master's was in literature, I think. And then I became a historian as a grad student. The hardest part was trying to tackle both my literary analysis scholar self and become a historian. And how do you balance these two trainings? I think that was the hard part. And I was always very unsure that I was writing a properly historical book. So that was the big challenge, I think.
And finally, I have to ask you, you're moving to Zurich soon to take up this really fascinating chairship of the Anthropocene. Tell us a little bit about that and what you hope to do with that in the next few years.
Wow, so I'm very excited in the midst of moving. At the moment, excitement is waning when I look at boxes and things that you move. But no, I'm really excited because it's a very interesting position. And I'm kind of also very excited that they chose me and the kind of work I do. So the two projects I'll be developing there will be, of course, one of them will be my book. And the task here, I think, is how do we meld economic and social histories with environmental histories? In a way, trying to bring them, bring that really in conversation in some ways. And Zurich is a place that the position I'm taking up has a long history of being one of the premier centers of economic social histories done in a certain way, where they work on banking, where they work on histories of insurance. So I really want to do this as a joint project together. That's one. And the other project that I am going to be working on, hopefully it will be part of this work I said I was doing with maps, looking at maps, is really trying to understand the kind of a longer history of juridification of nature in multiple ways, and how these kind of mobile landscape became kind of sites of experiments for legal questions. And one of the places I'm thinking through at the moment is the Bhashanchor, which is this unregulated land, which is where the Rohingyas has been housed, where of course any claim to any kind of asylum is tenuous, precisely because the land under your feet is melting. So what does it mean to make use solely claims? And a lot of people are thinking about, geographers like Lindsay Bremner is thinking about this very carefully. So I want to do a much larger project in thinking about these kind of spaces and what sort of, and not as fringes of legal thinking, but as the heart where legal experiments are happening and then get brought back to the thing. So those are the two projects I am excited about doing there.
And that was Devjani Bhattacharya, the author of Empire and Ecology in the Bengal Delta, The Making of Calcutta. I'm Karthik Nachipan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.